Today's presenting sponsor is a special one for us here at Crooked Media. Love it. As you know, this podcast would not exist if it wasn't for President Obama. My career wouldn't exist. I don't know.
Yeah, who knows where we'd be?
Man, I remember like when I got the job with Edwards, I was choosing between that and going to work at Club Med as a geo, which meant basically you trip kids while playing street hockey or basketball or whatever. But as you all probably know, we've been inspired by President Obama and his work inside and outside of office. So we're excited to announce that the Obama Presidential Center officially opens this June on the south side of Chicago. It is so much more than just a library. It is an entire campus geared towards helping everyday people realize their ability to make real world change. Beyond the immersive museum exhibits, there's an athletic center, a theater, a media lab, and a branch of the Chicago Public Library, a collection of brand new commissioned art, world-class performances, and original programming. The list goes on. It's a very special place. I'm excited to see the Obama Presidential Center. Hopefully get out there for like, I don't know.
Yeah, could go see it.
Plan your visit at Obama.org and sign up for exclusive updates and special offers. The Obama Presidential Center, bring change home.
Save big on your landscape project at Menards. Whether you're shopping for edgers, pavers, or wall blocks, Menards has the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape block ready to take home today. Build a beautiful border for your landscape with our interlock edgers on sale now through March 22nd. Save big on landscape block at Menards. Also, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Welcome to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, hello from New Zealand. I think it's 21 hours difference here. It's a little,
What insane. Time is it there?
So it is, where's my phone? It is Wednesday, February 11th at 11:07.
So you're like way ahead. Yeah.
So you get on the plane. I got on the plane at 10:30 at night in LA time. And then you land on Tuesday. So you just like Thanos a day.
Yep.
And Monday you just get it back. Never exists.
If you come back, you'll get it back.
You get it back on the way in, on the way back. You get it back. But it's like basically the easiest way to think about it. It's like negative 21, or you guys are 21 behind me. But in practice, it's as if you're 3 hours ahead. So I'm just treating you like you're in New York and I'm in LA.
That makes sense. Well, I mean, I hope you've been able to lick your wounds out there. There's not a lot of people talking Patriots, Drake May.
I was wondering if you're going to get to this. So I did pack one sweatshirt, and it is a Patriots sweatshirt. Luckily, it's pretty warm in New Zealand and Australia this time of year. But yeah, it's tough. It's,
you have a 22-year-old quarterback. I think he'll be back. I think he'll be fine.
Listen, you know, just be grateful you made it there. I guess apparently the whole Patriots didn't play anyone good strength of schedule thing, they had a point.
Yeah, that kind of bore out. That kind of bore out. I mean, you had the Bo Nix go down. I mean, but hey, you know, you got there. You got. I'm a Jets fan. Like, we haven't smelled the Super Bowl since before I was born. So
no, you're you just watch former quarterbacks win Super Bowls. Shout out Sam.
I know. One of our guys. Yeah, yeah.
Ben, did you see this morning, or maybe it was yesterday? Who knows when it was? Trump threatened to close down the Gordie Howe Bridge between Michigan and Ontario.
I did.
And, social posts. I want to read you a verbatim quote and tell me if this sort of vibes with the intelligence you read about China back in the day.
Yeah.
Prime Minister Carney wants to make a deal with China, which will eat Canada alive. We'll just get the leftovers. I don't think so. The first thing China will do is terminate all ice hockey being played in Canada and permanently eliminate the Stanley Cup. Are you aware of Xi Jinping being in support of like a hockey genocide?
I'm not, nor am I aware of Trump being commissioner of the National Hockey League. But maybe, you know, if the Canadians want to be smart about it, you know, Wayne Gretzky's super MAGA hanging out with Trump all the time. Maybe they should just rename the bridge the Wayne Gretzky Bridge and then they keep it open. I don't know.
That's a pretty good idea. Yeah. Gordie Howe was a badass.
He was a badass. Punch. Yeah.
All right. So we got a wide range of topics today, kind of befitting our 21-hour time difference. We're going to start in the UK, where Prime Minister Keir Starmer is facing calls to resign based on his administration's association with Jeffrey Epstein. Accountability must be nice. We're also going to tell you about a landslide election in Japan and how those results could permanently change the constitution and character of the country.
Trump's got a big trip to China coming up in April. We'll explain how two major issues in the U.S.-China relationship are threatening to derail that visit. We're also going to update you on these reports we talked about last week about the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, suppressing this super-duper top-secret, only-allowed-one-copy-in-a-safe whistleblower report. So since we talked, Congress finally got a copy of the thing, and then some details have leaked out in the media. And then finally, we're going to check in on the Olympics. We got the cheers, the boos, the cheating scandal that somehow involves inflated penises, but not sex. So we'll unpack all that one, scandal that's rocking the
it's
Olympic.
Scandal for our times, if ever there was one. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Metaphorically rocking that is. and then Ben, you did our interview today. What are we going
to
hear?
Yeah, I talked to Nilou Tabrizi, who's been on before. She's was actually just laid off from the Washington Post, where she was an investigative reporter focused on Iran, wrote an extraordinary book about Iran. And
well, nothing's happening there, so it's a good time to kind of make sure we have less insight into that.
Exactly. I mean, her being fired at this moment actually points to the absolute absurdity of what they just did there. But we talked about how that went down, what it was like, literally, like, you know, how do they lay off all those people? What's going to be lost with all these foreign desks going away? Where international news coverage might be going in this period of, you know, consolidation and layoffs, the Jeff Bezos of it all, and what it's like to feel like you've been laid off by a guy that, you know, could have like lost the change in his couch that would have paid for the Washington Post for the rest of his life, and also her impression of what's happening in Iran based on her conversations with sources. So, really important conversation. People should check it out.
Yeah, the marketing budget on the Melania movie could have saved what like the entire Forum bureaus basically for several years. So, yeah. That's great. Well, I'm excited to listen to that. I'm sorry that that happened to her. Obviously, we here at Pod Save the World cannot replace like major media institutions like the Washington Post, but I think that story is a sign that they are billionaires are not coming to save us. So if you want to help support independent progressive media, you know, thanks for watching the show. Thanks for subscribing. Subscribe if you're watching on YouTube. Subscribe if you're listening as a podcast. But if you if that's not enough for you, if you want to, you know, do even more and become a supporter of Crooked Media itself, please consider becoming a paid subscriber. It really is the single most important thing you could do to help us grow as a company. You get lots of bonus content. You get ad-free episodes. You get a lot more if you just go to crooked.com/friends for more information. We have experienced explosive growth over here, Ben. People are calling us the Bad Bunny of podcasting if you want to dip into that little mini scandal from over the weekend. Just like people that are mad about the Super Bowl halftime show, just like, just mute it.
Well, and it was also like an absolute banger and a very worldo halftime show with the end with all the Americas. I had a little tear in the eye on that one.
It was cool. It was like watching like a movie. It was just like
it really was. Well, and actually, interesting. Yeah, it was like I grew up in New York where there are 2 million, I think, Puerto Ricans, and so I was like, oh yeah, like that. Some of that was familiar to me, but then it was just so deep in that culture. It was pretty extraordinary to immerse in it like that. So anyway, I loved it.
Shocked that Trump was mad about it. What a surprise.
Oh, what a surprise. Well, a Kid Rock show is, you know, I'm sure that's great.
I love people were tweeting out like lyrics from his songs that are like about, you know, suck on my balls, this or that. It's like, okay, have fun. You're a Christian halftime show. Yeah, everybody.
Real Turning Point USA content there.
Kid Rock hasn't been cool for 25 years, if ever.
If ever.
Okay. So we got, let's start with the UK because, you know, while our president has faced no consequences for his decades-long close personal friendship with disgraced pedophile Jeffrey Epstein, there are growing calls for British Prime Minister Keir Starmer to resign over his government's ties to Epstein. So some quick context just to catch everybody up here. Until late last summer, the British ambassador to the US was a guy named Peter Mandelson. Mandelson was once a top aide to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, though Mandelson had a rocky career that kind of like was waylaid by repeated scandals. But despite that checkered history, and despite the fact that it was pretty well known that Mandelson had a relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, Starmer still made him the ambassador to the US. Now, Mandelson was ultimately fired from that post last September after the House Oversight Committee released a bunch of emails between Epstein and Mandelson that showed they remained close even after Epstein had been convicted of soliciting sex from a minor. I think he was emailing him about crashing at his place, like while Epstein was in jail or on, you know, whatever like cushy jail he had in Florida. And then, though, things got exponentially worse for Labour after that latest tranche of Epstein files were released by DOJ that revealed that Mandelson was forwarding Jeffrey Epstein's sensitive government information. We talked about this last week, but it was like genuinely shocking stuff, like secret details about the US and UK response to the financial crisis, internal memos that went to then Prime Minister Gordon Brown, much more. So Starmer now says that Mandelson lied to him and lied to his team during the vetting for the job. Keir Starmer was pressed on this question of what vetting was done with Mandelson during Prime Minister's question time. Here's a bit of that answer. And then there's another clip from Starmer apologizing to victims at a separate event. And then you'll hear Starmer's even more defiant tone on Tuesday. Let's watch.
Can the Prime Minister tell us, did the official security vetting he received mention Mandelson's ongoing relationship with the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein? So
clear. Prime Minister.
Yes, it did. As a result, various questions were put to him. I want to make sure this House sees the full documentation so it will see for itself the extent to which time and time again Mandelson completely misrepresented the extent of his relationship with Epstein and lied throughout the process, including in response to the due diligence. The victims of Epstein have lived with trauma that most of us can barely comprehend. I am sorry. Sorry for what was done to you. Sorry that so many people with power failed you. Sorry for having believed Mandelson's lies and appointed him.
There are some people in recent days who say the Labour government should have a different fight, a fight with itself, instead of a fight for the millions of people who need us to fight for them. And I say to them, I will never walk away from the mandate I was given to change this country. The fight coming up in politics, the real fight, is not in the Labour Party. It's with the right-wing politics that challenges that, the politics of reform.
So Morgan McSweeney, who is Keir Starmer's now former chief of staff, took responsibility for pushing the select Mandelson for that job. McSweeney has since resigned. But the question is, will that be enough? And really, like, will members of the Labour Party decide that this is their moment to push out Keir Starmer and make a leadership change that many of them already wanted? Because Labour's approval rating has basically been heading in a line straight down since the last election in 2024. According to The Economist, Keir Starmer is now the most unpopular prime minister in their recorded history. His net approval rating is worse than Liz Truss at her lowest, though, Ben, she was defenestrated after only 49 days, so maybe it's not a fair comparison. Anas Sarwar, the head of the Scottish Labour Party, called on Starmer to resign. Here's just a bit of what he had to say.
The situation in Downing Street is not good enough. There have been too many mistakes. They promised they were going to be different, but too much has happened. Have there been good things? Of course there have, many of them. But no one knows them and no one can hear them because they're being drowned out. That's why it cannot continue. Keir Starmer is a decent man. And it is no secret that I've always got on well with him and he has dedicated his life to public service. I have also dedicated myself to public service, and I need to decide what I'm willing to accept and what I'm willing to tolerate.
Okay, so Ben, so far, like, the top Labour ministers are all sticking with Keir Starmer and backing him publicly, but like this challenge is not really about Jeffrey Epstein. It's about, like, for Starmer, it's about getting the economy going, demonstrating a clear vision to voters, convincing the rest of the Labour Party that you're the guy for this moment. And I have to say, like, it feels very hard to see how he's going to right this ship and serve out a full term. Like, he might survive this near term issue, but, like, I don't know, man, he's got like a dead man walking vibe. But what do you think?
I agree with you. And I think it's worth kind of doing the brief journey to how we got here. And first of all, it's interesting, and Alex and I talked about this in Pots of America, Tommy, but the fact that Keir Starmer wasn't even in the Epstein files.
I know.
Right? And yet he may be taken out by one person who's in the files, Mandelson, and all these Americans are evading all this accountability, including a current president and maybe a former president. I wish we still had a system where shame and transparency You know, not that the British system is perfect by any measure, but at least that there's still some gravity there.
I know. And like Howard Lutnick, like the Commerce Secretary, like he like made up a story about like cut ties on TV and then went to fucking Epstein Island, was doing business deals with the guy.
Yeah.
Like, fire your Commerce Secretary. No one gives a shit about the Commerce Secretary. Anyway, continue.
Well, no, but that's the point, right? The point is that we don't fire anybody. But look, Morgan McSweeney is central to this whole thing. And I've met Morgan McSweeney a bunch of times. And so I met him right when Keir Starmer became leader. And this guy was like the, you know, David Axelrod, he was the absolute political strategist, like dictatorial political strategist at the Labour Party. And he orchestrated a very successful, for his purposes and Starmer's purposes, reorientation of the Labour Party. So it's coming out of Jeremy Corbyn. They'd taken a left turn. They basically purged all the Jeremy Corbyn people, made a big show of purging some anti-Semitic elements, tacked to the center, rebuilt bridges to the kind of Blair class of the Labour Party. And that's where Peter Mandelson comes in, because he's the quintessential version of, he's not a leftist, he's an operator. You know, he's a guy that is, you know, Mr. Globalization, right? And all the way to the worst parts that Jeffrey
knows
Epstein
all the bankers, has lots of contacts. Exactly, yeah.
And so where this all comes together is that Mandelson as ambassador reflected like poor judgment. You know, you should have looked a little harder at him. But it also reflected a choice that Starmer made from the beginning about how to govern, which is to take that kind of cautious, always look over your right shoulder, tack to the center, befriend the globalist approach. And you know, the kind of Peter Mandelson politics, that became, I think, to a lot of people at least, what Keir Starmer was projecting. So it's both the immediate scandal. It's also the fact that this was the play they made. It wasn't just that Mandelson was ambassador to the UK. They kind of took on that approach to politics, and it's worked out horribly for them. And the reason I agree with you, too, Tommy, is that, like, if he was a strong, you know, in the polls and he was doing well, like, I think he could survive this. But ultimately, he's in the toilet with his numbers. And what happens in the UK is they have these by-elections. You know, these are kind of our version of off-year local elections that are kind of bellwethers for where the public mood is. And if Labour gets absolutely pasted in one or a succession of those elections, then I think you might see the final dam break and Starmer have to go.
Yeah, and they've done a lot of the shuffling stuff. Like, I think his communications director, Starmer's communications director, also quit on Monday. You know, the Economist noted that in 19 months, Keir Starmer has lost 2 chiefs of staff, 4 directors of communications, and 11 ministers. So they've been doing the kind of internal reshuffle thing.
The deck chairs,
it ain't working. And to your point, like, you know, they campaigned on, you know, taxes not going up. It's clear they can't really keep that promise. They campaigned hard as an effort to, you know, sort of defang the right wing on stopping the small boats and cutting down on immigration. They haven't been able to deliver on that, in part because you can never kind of outright wing the right wing. And so I think I saw Starmer's approval rating is now at 23%, right? Oh, by the way, Ben, Axios had a list of like European leader approval ratings. Macron is at the bottom with 16%. Friedrich Merz over in Germany is at 21%. Keir Starmer is at 23%. But then also I saw YouGov did surveys tracking Europeans' opinions of the U.S., and more than 60% of the population of Denmark, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, and Great Britain now have an unfavorable view of the U.S. That includes 72% of Germans and 84% of Danes. So you have these, like, unpopular European leaders and then populations that are starting to hate America. And it just, none of this feels good. Also, by the way, like, police are also now investigating whether Prince Andrew broke the law by sharing other documents with Epstein. So back onto your like accountability point, like it's only seemingly happening in the UK. There's zero accountability back home.
Yeah. And I think though that combination of there actually being accountability in Europe and their hatred of America these days, I think is going to motivate really aggressive investigations into the Epstein file follow-ups, right? Including of the Americans in it, some of whom do business in Europe. And so we may be in this kind of strange position where the most aggressive legal and journalistic follow-through on the Epstein files, including related to Americans, is going to happen in Europe because they're pissed over there. Like that's one thing you take away from all those polls is people are pissed and Epstein kind of is the worst version of American hegemony, let's just say, right? Some just just monster, right, who's also got this network of powerful people. So, you know, that's something to watch too, not just kind of what happens. Can Keir's, I mean, what you can hear him doing is something he should have done from the beginning, which is trying to pick a fight with Nigel Farage and just, you know, make it a choice, essentially. But he's not a particularly combative guy. He's not comfortable in the culture wars. He's been very, like, you know, defensive, as you say, on immigration. Not sure that that will work for him. We'll see. Maybe it will. Maybe he can right the ship. But I do think either way, this kind of European anger among publics and elites is going to probably motivate them digging deep on what they can find on Epstein.
100%, because in fact, what you're also seeing is, you know, like the Danish prime minister, Mette Frederiksen, her approval rating is up because she told Trump where to shove it, right?
Yeah, so yeah. Good for her.
When we're unpopular over there, and you're seeing polling, like, leaders benefit in the polls from seeming tough in confronting Trump, like, we know where this is going to go. One other update, Ben. So last week, we did this big section on Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence. She had been in the news a bunch because she was weirdly, like, on the scene at the FBI's raid of the Fulton County election office in Georgia, which was very weird. Turns out Trump told her to be there. And then there was this mysterious Wall Street Journal report about Tulsi blocking a whistleblower complaint from being sent up to Congress, in part because it was highly classified, but also seemingly because of politics. So since then, the intelligence community's inspector general has turned the report itself, the whistleblower report, over to Congress. The so-called Gang of Eight, which is the chairman and vice chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, chairman and ranking member in the House Intelligence Committee, then the Speaker, House Minority Leader, Senate Majority Leader, and Senate Minority Leader, all of that access to it. There's also been some news reports about the substance of the whistleblower report. The Guardian says the NSA intercepted a conversation between two individuals connected with a foreign intelligence service talking about someone close to Trump. Now, the sourcing in this story, the Guardian story, is a lawyer for one of the whistleblowers. And bizarrely, Ben, like, the lawyer initially told the Guardian that the call was between a foreign intel person and a Trump aide, but then had to, like, clarify that he misspoke. So it's all a little weird. And then the Times kind of followed up on that. And they said it's not clear where the individuals are from, but that the discussion itself involved Iran. And the report, the whistleblower report, was drafted around when Trump was considering whether or not to strike Iran. So maybe that gives us some more sort of visibility into this thing. The Times also says, like, there's a debate about the underlying value of the intelligence or whether these, you know, intel people were gossiping or spreading disinformation or what. But it does seem pretty clear that Gabbard screwed up either unintentionally or intentionally by not getting this report over to Congress in the timeframe required. And while there may have been some complexity to it, given, you know, the level of classification and limited reasons to distribute it, she also passed a copy along to Susie Wiles, Trump's chief of staff, which suggests there was some, like, political ass covering happening. So I don't know, man, like what do you make of this as we're getting these little drips of information? Anything, like, any clarity?
No clarity. I mean, we could jump to the conspiracy theorizing. There's heavy Steve Witkoff vibes in here. You know, maybe not a Trump aide, but he's involved in Iran. You know, yep. I don't know. But we don't know. Yep. We don't know. Here's what jumped out to me, Tommy. I mean, first of all, people should know. Sure, the NSA vacuums up all these calls. I presume that Trump's NSA is probably even less, you know, restrained than the Obama NSA, which got in a lot of hot water. But it's very unusual for there to be a complaint like this. So in other words, you know, presumably incidentally, there might be collection that involves an American with foreigners or foreign intelligence services or governments. There's nothing unusual about that. It'd have to be pretty, you know, alarming for someone to do this, I think. That's one point.
I agree.
The second point is that Trump's style of decision-making and the kind of loose nature of having, like, this inner circle that encompasses people in government and out of government kind of lends itself to this kind of problem. Because I actually have talked to people in foreign governments who deal with the Trump administration, and what they do is, because there's no formal process that works, right? Like, just having the meeting with Marco Rubio or the State Department doesn't work. You just start calling people that are in Trump's orbit. You know, you're calling Witkoff, you're calling Jared, but you're also calling, like, somebody you know is going to Mar-a-Lago next weekend.
Right. Hey, Roger Stone.
You're calling Roger Stone, or you're calling Steve Bannon, or people who you think get in the door to see Trump. You're calling Tucker Carlson, you know. And it kind of it lends itself to this, you know, we've talked about it lends itself to corruption. It also just kind of lends itself to, like, potential malign influence, right? Where, you know, you're trying to court, you know, some foreign intelligence service or government is, you know, this is our guy, let's go to that guy. And, you know, meanwhile, maybe they're doing business with that guy too. You know, like, this whistleblower complaint is probably indicative of a much bigger problem that is obviously going to be the case if this is how you conduct foreign policy.
Yeah, and like, we're seeing this play out in the domestic realm too. I mean, there's all these guys, lawyers, former aides to Trump, that are basically setting up cottage industries where they try to sell you a pardon. Right. Yeah. You pay him $1 million and they'll get to the right person to get, you know, whoever pardoned Juan Orlando Hernandez, the former, you know, head of state who was convicted of trafficking 400 tons of cocaine to the United States. Like, sure, you know, nothing's off the table here. So you're right. This does. It's a weird story. You know, Tom Cotton, a Republican from Arkansas, is like playing it down, saying it's no big deal.
Oh, he plays everything.
He did the right thing. But yeah, real straight shooter there. But I don't know. Hopefully we'll learn more. This is one of the things where, like, the fact that it's classified, I think, kind of leads to so much more allure. Like, maybe if they could just put it out, it might be.
It's probably, yeah.
Less of a big deal, but I'd love to know.
I think the big deal is what it says probably about how business is done, you know, which is this murky. You know, there's a reason you have process. There's a reason you want the people who deal with foreign governments to be employees of the United States government. You know, there's a reason you don't want your Middle East envoy to have a son who's in the crypto business doing huge deals, right? Like, all these things just lend itself to this kind of, you know, ambiguity.
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal had a piece out, I think, yesterday about, like, I forget what the total was, like $1.4 billion has been made by the Trump family from their crypto businesses, with like Zach Witkoff, Steve Witkoff's son, in charge of it. So yeah, there's a lot of avenues for corruption.
Pathy of the World is brought to you by American Giant. It sucks when you buy a new t-shirt, wear it twice, wash it a couple times, and it's just gone. It just falls apart. It looks like crap. A lot of outerwear, it's not made to last, and especially when you need it to be warm out. This time of year, a good hoodie is essential, but it can be tough to find one that will last through the season. The American Giant Classic Full Zip Hoodie is made to last a lifetime, so you can count on it to bring you comfort and warmth year after year. Slate Magazine called it the greatest hoodie ever made, and from cotton to zipper, it's made right here in the USA.
I love my American Giant sweatshirts.
I do too. I got great sweatpants too. Speaking of items I need to hold up to a lot of wear. My kids are constantly smearing crap all over them, so they're getting washed all the time, and they still fit great. They look good, like the day I got them. So I really like them. And the great hoodie is a staple for any wardrobe. The iconic classic full zip hoodie is the jacket that started it all for American Giant. Custom heavyweight fleece and side panels for mobility make it the best hoodie ever. Body skimming fit with double lined hoods and reinforced elbow patches mean this hoodie will last. Born from a commitment to support the communities that create its products, every American Giant piece is made in America and designed to last. No exceptions. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. We love a good item of clothing. And we're also old enough to remember that when American Made Jeans got you an HBO show. So salute you, American Giant. This season, snag the hoodie that will bring you comfort for life, the American Giant Classic Full Zip, and save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com. And you can use the code WORLD at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code WORLD. Pod Save the World is brought to you by Sundays for Dogs. We all love the idea of feeding our dogs real fresh food, but the reality is that fresh dog food usually means taking up freezer space, time to thaw and prep, and then a lot of mess when you serve it. Get the good without the hassle with Sundays. Sundays was founded by a veterinarian and mom, Dr. Tori Waxman, who got tired of seeing so-called premium dog food full of fillers and synthetics. So she designed Sundays, air-dried real dog food made in human-grade kitchens using the same ingredients and care you'd use to cook for yourself and your family. Every bite of Sundays is clean and made from 100% meat and superfoods with no kibble. That means no weird ingredients you can't pronounce and no fillers. Compared to kibble or other brands out there, Sundays invest 50 times more in its ingredients to ensure premium quality. Because your dog deserves food made with care, not in the interest of cost cutting. And the best part? You just scoop and serve. No freezer, no thawing, no prep, no mess. Just nutrient-rich, clean food that fuels their happiest, healthiest days so you get more of them to share together. Love our dogs.
Yeah, we do. We do love our dogs.
Like family, they are family. And so, of course, you want to feed your dog the best food you can. You want to make them happy. You want them to be healthy. You want them to have more energy and a better mood, more calm and focused and softer fur and all the good stuff. Make the switch to Sundays. Go right now to sundaysfordogs.com/world50 to get 50% off your first order. Or you can use the code world50 at checkout. That's 50% off your first order at sundaysfordogs.com/world50. sundaysfordogs.com/world50 or use the code world50 at checkout.
All right, Ben, so let's turn to Japan, where Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi's gamble to call a snap early election to consolidate her power turned out to be a staggering success. So Takaichi's party, the LDP, they won this historic victory on Sunday. They picked up more than 100 seats outright, which means the LDP has about 316 seats on their own. And then with their coalition partners, they now control over 350 of the 465-seat lower house of the National Diet, which is Japan's legislature. So Takaichi basically pulled a reverse Keir Starmer here. She got, like, when she became prime minister, she barely got enough support from within the party to get the job. But then 100 days later, she calls this election and she delivered her party a supermajority through it. And the win was because of her, not because of the LDP's popularity. The LDP, as we've talked about before, like they've basically ruled Japan since 1955 with two brief kind of interruptions. But after former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's resignation in 2020, the party's been a bit of a mess. They've had a bunch of like terrible candidates for prime minister and they've been losing support. And so what Takaichi did is she seems to have almost single-handedly revived the party and in the process destroyed the traditional opposition parties. They just got crushed in the polls. And so the question now is, what is she going to do with this power? Takaichi has talked about drastically ramping up Japan's defense spending in Japan's defense industry. That's an option. She's talked about amending Japan's constitution, in particular Article 9, which renounces war and codifies Japan as a pacifist nation. That language was basically written by the U.S. and imposed on Japan in 1947 after World War II. She's also talked about major spending to juice the economy and drive growth. So we just don't know. Like, I guess we'll now wait and see what she decides. Maybe it'll be a hybrid. Maybe it'll be parts, not other parts. But like the thing to know is that basically no one can stop her, like not the opposition in parliament, not her own party. Ben, what did you make of the results and how she ran and what it means for the balance of power, you know, in Asia and the partnership with the U.S.?
Well, it connects back to what you said about the Prime Minister of Denmark, right? Because Takaichi, and we said this at the time, like she got in this fight with the Chinese and she doubled down on it. And that nationalism played well. Like we're at a time when people want strong leaders who seem like they're standing up for national interests. And so she's another case in point, and she's on the right. But I think, frankly, you could be on the right or the left if, you know, people want to see kind of strong leadership and she kind of sensed that mood. Now, she's very conservative, and then that leads to what the ramifications of this are. And look, I mean, Japan has been, in its constitution, a nation, you know, dedicated only to having self-defense, not having any militarism, given its past and given the U.S. role in drafting that constitution. But it also has had this kind of building set of complicated relationships in its neighborhood. It would take a long time to unpack why, but I think from the outside in, from the Chinese or South Korean perspective, for instance, it's that Japan didn't necessarily atone for its wartime sins in the way even that a Germany has. You know, the wounds are still raw. But at the same time, from the Japanese perspective, the Chinese Communist Party has been stirring up anti-Japanese nationalism for a long time, and it is virulent. I mean, I see some of this stuff. And so it's got to be kind of scary to have this giant country next to you that is getting stronger and stronger and is part of its identity is kind of hating, you know, Japan. And at the same time, the U.S. is not the reliable security guarantor that it has been because Trump, you know, while he hasn't really, you know, singled out Japan this time around, can you really trust that the U.S. is going to be there to defend you against China? And so I think there's some natural things that we're building over time in terms of the security dimension of the region, in terms of the U.S. alliance. And then along comes, you know, the Margaret Thatcher of Japan. And I think we're going to find out what it's like. And what while I think some of this was inevitable, and she may also think maybe I can jumpstart growth by putting a lot of money in defense. I don't know. But it's a little worrisome, you know, because if you've got this flashpoint in the Taiwan Strait, And that's what got her in trouble with the Chinese in the first place. She said that that was, you know, important to Japan's defense. And you start to have a more muscular Japan that's going to freak out the Chinese. And, you know, it just adds to the tinderbox feeling of geopolitics right now.
Yeah, that was one of my takeaways, too. I mean, look, just in terms of what she could do, like, you know, she could take steps that make the prime minister more powerful, right? Like she could change it so she has more power during a crisis. She could lower the bar for future constitutional amendments. She could just sort of like add clauses to the constitution that recognize the self-defense provisions of the military. There's sort of smaller, more incremental steps she could take than the ones I kind of laid out at the top. But like, I had the same reaction you did, Ben, which was, you know, the FT mentioned that like the Beijing warned Takeuchi against, quote, retracing the road of militarism. And as you said, like obviously the Chinese are more than a touch hypocritical here, but it does worry me that one of Trump's like core policy things is pushing countries like Germany, Austria, Italy, Japan to invest more in defense spending.
Yeah.
Right as we are seeing a rise in these like right-wing parties in these countries. And it's like, I don't know, guys, this could end very badly.
But yeah,
we've seen it before.
That collection of you know, that access has not always been the best in the past. But I think that the you know, foreign policy, sometimes people don't appreciate that success is just the absence of worse things happening. Mm-hmm. And if you look at Northeast Asia, you've got like nuclear armed North Korea divided from U.S. aligned South Korea. Emerging Chinese Communist Party superpower in Beijing, Japan, like there's been stability somehow among those countries in the sense that there hasn't been a war and economic growth has been allowed to, you know, explode and people trade even if they, you know, don't like each other. And now if all of those countries are turning, you know, with the exception of South Korea for now, in this kind of direction, I don't know. Like, can that hold for 10 years? I mean, because, you know, she's got beef with the Chinese, but I'm sure the North Koreans too, and vice versa, you know? And so if the U.S. is kind of receding from this role of being the kind of security guarantor and we're so big and present that nobody will mess with it, if we're kind of pulling back from that, the concern is, you know, there's opportunity maybe in having a different balance of power in the world and new rules, but the downside could be giant vacuums and, you know, the road of militarism, to quote Chinese propaganda, leading to you know, uncomfortable destinations.
Yeah, and a couple of weeks ago, we talked about Xi Jinping's purge of all the senior leaders in the Chinese military. And again, for what folks need to understand there is like the PLA, the Chinese military, it's not like the country's military. It's the armed wing of the Chinese Communist Party. So you're not necessarily elevated because you fought hard or bravely. It's like you greased the right guy, you bribed the right official. So you could have people with like zero fucking actual military experience at the top of the organization who don't really fully understand the horrors of war at a time when you have this rising military in Japan. And yeah, like you said, like sometimes you don't get a lot of credit as a leader for the dogs that kind of didn't bark or the problems that didn't arise during your tenure. But what you outlined could be a big one. Speaking of China, Ben, so there were two stories out of China that we wanted to flag. The first is Hong Kong media mogul Jimmy Lai was sentenced to 20 years in prison under the national security law that China imposed on Hong Kong back in 2020 after the huge protests in 2019 and 2020. So this sentence, Jimmy Lai's sentence, is the longest sentence ever given under the national security law. And it probably means he will die in prison unless something changes. He'd be like, you know, late 90s when his sentence technically ends. The prosecution is clearly politically motivated. It's an effort to shut down his newspaper, Apple Daily. It's an effort to just crush any lingering hope for press freedom in Hong Kong generally. So that is very bad. The second story is about Taiwan. So the Financial Times reported that the Trump administration is pulling together another really large arms package for Taiwan that includes some big ticket items like Patriot missiles. Back in December, the U.S. approved an $11 billion arms sale to Taiwan, which it was massive then. And they say this next package could be nearly double that size. The number they quote in the story is up to $20 billion. The FT says when Xi Jinping talked to Trump on the phone last week, he raised this And they quote sources in the story saying that Beijing has warned the U.S. that the arms sale could derail Trump's visit to China in April. So, Ben, I just kind of I found this confluence of issues interesting because I think, you know, you and I have said on the show, like, we both assume Trump only cares about economics and getting a trade deal with China. However, in the past, he has promised to get Jimmy Lai out of prison. He actually said it would be easy to do so in an interview with Hugh Hewitt, who now has kind of gone quiet on the subject. But, like, you know, it's put up or shut up time. And the question is whether Trump will spend any political capital pushing Xi on Jimmy Lai or any other human rights issue during this visit. The cynic in me does wonder, Ben, if, like, China gives Jimmy Lai 20 years so they can cut a sentence down to 5 or 10 and Trump can call that a win and they still have their guy in jail, but put that aside. But this arms sale to Taiwan, it does feel like a much bigger hurdle and kind of harder to unwind given where the Republican Party is and given the congressional role in arming Taiwan. So I don't know, what was your read on what's happening here and, like, whether this actually creates some real turbulence for Trump as he heads to Beijing in April?
I think it does. And first of all, we should say Jimmy Lai is a hero. And he's rich enough that he could have gotten out of there at a certain point and lived a certain kind of life, but he stuck by his newspaper and his principles. Interesting contrast to Jeff Bezos, by the way. Jeff Bezos was not at risk of going to prison at all. Jimmy Lai gave everything up for what he believed. All we were asking Jeff Bezos to do is, you know, keep funding something. I mean, it just shows a difference. It's notable. I don't think that Xi Jinping would let Jimmy Lai out of prison. I mean, if I had to bet on it, because he's a hard ass, you know? I mean, he's, you know, that's, he just purged the military. He's quashed dissent in Hong Kong. I think he wouldn't want to be seen to be, you know, even doing a favor for Donald Trump in this kind of human rights space. Like, it's a space where there's usually a slammed door. I hope I'm wrong, but my sense is that wouldn't be in the offing. It might have been earlier, you know, at the beginning of the Trump administration. But now, I mean, I think she's, all his moves suggest a guy internally and externally who's moving at a deliberate pace, but only in one direction, you know. And yeah, that's a fairly confrontational direction with the United States on certain things. That leads me to Taiwan. Like, I think Taiwan is the issue that we're going to be paying a lot more attention to over the next year or two. I mean, it has not featured yet, but it is the flashpoint. You know, they continue to shovel these weapons out the door to the Taiwanese. Trump probably likes arms sales for a variety of reasons. They do, you know, provoke Beijing. And in the past, the way that the Chinese have dealt with that is, yes, sometimes by canceling meetings, never a presidential visit, though. That would be a huge signal if they actually did that. I don't think they will. But what they tend to do in response is they'll do some, like, really aggressive military exercises around Taiwan. You know, they'll fly over their airspace or fly missiles over their mm-hmm. airspace, or, you know, have, like, an armada that, you know, is uncomfortably close to the Taiwanese, you know, land. And you know, that always can risk getting a little scratchy, right? And so I think that's what we're going to see, is, like, this kind of a bit of a spiral, unless Trump just chooses to kind of throw Taiwan overboard and agree to some formulation that essentially abandons them in terms of the U.S. coming to their defense. Either way, I think Taiwan is going to be something that we're talking about more and more over the next year or two.
Yeah, definitely one to watch as we head into April in particular.
This podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform designed to elevate your online presence and drive your success. Squarespace provides all the necessary tools to claim your domain, build a professional website, expand your brand, and facilitate payments, making it the ideal solution for businesses of all sizes. Squarespace gives you everything you need to offer services and get paid all in one place. From consultations to events and experiences, showcase your offerings with a customizable website designed to attract clients and grow your business. With their collection of cutting-edge design tools, anyone can build a bespoke online presence that perfectly fits their brand or business. Squarespace makes it easy to showcase your expertise and engage clients with video content on your website. Upload and organize your videos, create stunning video libraries, and even monetize your content by adding a paywall, perfect for online courses, exclusive tutorials, and premium workshops. Squarespace domains makes it easy to find the best name for your business at one fair, all-inclusive price, no hidden fees or add-ons required. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/world to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/world. Pod Save the World is brought to you by Built. It's 2026, and if you're still paying rent without Built, it is time for a change. Built is a loyalty program for renters that rewards you for your biggest monthly expense, rent. With Built, every rent payment earns you points that can be used towards flights, hotels, Lyft rides, Amazon.com purchases, and much more. And here's something to get excited about. Now, Built members can earn points on mortgage payments for the first time. That means you can get rewarded wherever you live and unlock exclusive benefits from more than 45,000 restaurants, fitness studios, pharmacies, and other neighborhood partners. They have a lot of great options here. You can do fitness classes like SoulCycle, Barry's, Pure Bar. They got the travel portal if you want to plan a vacation. You can just put them on Amazon.com. You can get Lyft rides. There's tons of different ways you could spend your Built points and make your rent work for you. It's simple. Paying rent is better with Built, and now owning a home can be better with Built too. Earn rewards and get something back wherever you live. Join the loyalty program for renters at joinbuilt.com/world. That's joinbuilt.com/world. Make sure to use our URL so they know we sent you.
Finally, Ben, the Winter Olympics are happening in Italy as we speak. So the host cities are technically Milan and Cortina, although the events are really happening all over northern Italy. Breezy Johnson won the first gold medal for the U.S. in downhill skiing. U.S. figure skaters won gold in the team competition in part thanks to the quad god, Ilya Malinin. Did I say that right? I don't know. Two great names.
Yeah.
Quad god and Breezy Johnson.
My daughters were into the quad god. Yeah.
Quad god. I mean, that's
history. Cool, well, because he can do these jumps that nobody else can do, you know, like that's
and the backflip.
Yeah.
Fucking wild.
Yeah.
There's also been some heartbreak. Lindsey Vonn, she was trying to come back at age 41 and trying to compete with a torn ACL. I do not understand how you do that. But had this horrible crash and had to be airlifted off of the course with a tibia fracture. So that was tough. Speaking of painful things to look at, Vice President J.D. Vance was booed when his face was shown on the stadium big screen at the opening ceremony, but he is not mad about it, Ben. Speaking of not mad, Donald Trump decided to personally attack a freestyle skier named Hunter Hess for daring to say that he doesn't agree with everything happening in the U.S. at all times, basically. Love all the free speech absolutists in the White House. And then finally, we have to talk about this ever-growing cheating scandal that is turning the sport of ski jumping upside down. So the German newspaper Bild reported that ski jumpers were allegedly injecting their penises with hyaluronic acid to enlarge them. So this is how this scheme would work. Ski jumpers wear special suits. They are specially made based on the size of the individual athlete's body, including the crotch area. So those measurements are determined by a 3D body scanner, and they're taken in front of a doctor. So that the total size of the suit matters, though, because even a small amount of additional fabric or material on the suit can create more drag and more lift and help you fly farther. So the theory goes, you inject your junk with this acid. It's like lip filler, basically. It swells up. You get fitted for a bigger suit with more surface area. You go further. Now, this story is probably total bullshit. And the junk juicing would have had to happen like months ago when the suits were made. So we can't like go out and test it now. But it is one of those stories that is too good to fact check. Ben, I have not had the Olympics on the last couple of days because I was on a plane for 7 trillion hours and now I'm in a time zone I can't understand. But what events are you watching?
First of all, I feel like this last segment is getting edgier and edgier with each passing week. I do one thing on the J.D. Vance and then the Olympics. It is weird and important that we, at an Olympics in Europe, we're kind of like the bad guys, you know? We're like the what the Soviet Union used to be when they showed up at these places. Yeah. You know, like our J.D. Vance is getting booed. Our athletes, poor athletes, are having to answer for, you know, ICE. And actually, most of them are saying the right things. But that's like, you know, that's as an American, that should make you uncomfortable. You know, I mean, any other time I was on the U.S. delegation to the closing ceremonies at the London Olympics. And, you know, they were cheering for American athletes like, you know, they were cousins or something, you know, so that was a little, you know, jarring. I love the Winter Olympics because I found myself watching curling.
Love little curling.
And trying to explain that to my kids was like an interesting journey. But I like the idea that there's still these subcultures of people around the world that do like one thing obsessively.
I totally agree.
And then every 4 years, like you get to see their excellence at it.
Bobsled is the same way, right? Yeah. It's like, and well, the better athletes over the bobsled. I mean, you're sprinting as fast as humanly possible and shoving a heavy ass sled, but it's cool as hell.
It is. And you know, I watch figure skating is on a lot in my house. I didn't want to watch Lindsey Vonn because I had a sense of foreboding about it. The ACL thing freaked me out. But On the ski jump junk scandal, besides being physically uncomfortable thinking about it, I'm bad enough with like injections to begin with in my arm. I don't know what to make me. I mean, it is interesting how performance enhancing drugs that used to just be like, you know, professional wrestlers, juice and steroids, or, you know, Mark McGuire, they seem to get like, as the rules to capture them become more aggressive, there's always some new frontier, you know? And this may be the final frontier, though. I can't think of one beyond this, to tell you
junk
the truth.
Juicing? Usually the juice shrinks the junk. There was a Norwegian team that was caught, I think, tampering with their suits to fly farther. So there is some precedent here. I feel like we're all getting clickbaited, but it's just too fun not to talk about it.
Or they're leaking this so that people think that they've got bigger junk.
There you go.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why, you know, that's why both of us were recruited for ski jumping. Did you see this? Did you see this Norwegian athlete today? I can't say this guy's name. I'm not even going to try.
Oh, the guy who admitted his guilt? Yeah.
Yeah, dude, Sturla Holm Lagrid. I don't know. It's one of those names where the two of the vowels are attached. So he won the bronze in the 20-kilometer biathlon. Then he used his post-win interview to disclose that he cheated on his girlfriend and was heartbroken and wanted to get her back. Here's the quote. I told her a week ago, and it's been the worst week of my life. I had a gold medal in life, and there's probably a lot of people out there who look at me differently now, but I only have eyes for her. Sports has taken a bit of a backseat these past couple of days. Yeah, I wish I could share this with her. I'm not ready to give up. I hope that committing social suicide might show her how much I love her. Social suicide there, I think it's meaning like bearing his soul on Norwegian TV. That's one way to give a speech.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting. These athletes, this is like the one moment, you know, maybe in their lives that they're going to have a camera pointed at them in a large audience. And some choose to like have political protests. And this is a different choice. But to me, that's what it reinforces. Like, what do you say if you get one shot to make some announcement to the world? And I don't know. I'm curious if there's any follow-up on this story, because I don't know if
this is like the Will Smith slap of Olympic speeches. Also, dude, you won the fucking bronze. You know what I mean? You're stealing the shine from other people. This woman must be so pissed. She's like, you're airing.
Well, now,
out
yeah, now you're embarrassed. It's like the Reynolds pamphlet in Hamilton. Now I sound like a total lib, but you're just published. You're just kind of humiliating this woman all over again in front of the whole world. I don't know. It seems like weird judgment. I will say, I love that event. And when I like the idea that you're going to ski and shoot things, and you know, so that's the Winter Olympics. That's what the kind of stuff I like, these kind of sports that make no sense.
Is that one of the ones where you like you cross country ski,
isn't it?
And then your like heart is exploding, then you lay down, and you have to like shoot it.
I think that's what it is. I mean, I could be wrong, but I think that's what it is. Yeah. I love that sport because like, who invented that? Like some Finns fighting off the Russians or something.
That's exactly right. Dudes up in Finland battling like Soviet troops and the trees in World War One.
Yeah, like, oh, we should make this a sport. You know, you're like, Jurgen's really good. You know,
Jurgen. Oh man, yeah, I love the Olympics too, man. It's fun when you're like with a group, you know, the kind of like nationalism, the juices get flowing, you get a good USA chant going. It does just suck. Like these poor athletes are being asked, they're up, they're doing press conferences because they have to. They're getting asked political questions. They're trying to offer like really measured responses, and then the president of the United States fucking unloads on you, probably because he saw a tweet from Jake Paul or something. Yeah, what are we doing?
Yeah, what are we doing? Come on, I mean. Jesus.
It's just like everyone's just got to be mad about fewer things. Like I will vote for a presidential candidate that promises to like not tweet about the halftime show at the Super Bowl, to ban gender reveals, just like a couple, like just to shut up after like 8 p.m., you know, like no like white nationalist videos about the Obamas where you like turn them into monkeys. Yes. Like how about that? That's like all I'm asking for.
Well, I have to tell you, Tommy, like it got me thinking about, I mean, I thought this before too, but we've got the Olympics here in LA in 2 years, and Trump is going to be the fucking president.
Yep.
And that thing is going to be a nightmare because he's going to be like on his way out, Mad King, you know, Rosebud moment for Citizen Kane. What should be a really exciting thing to have the Olympics coming to Los Angeles, I have like this foreboding about, you know?
I do too. Yes. I mean, he's got the World Cup and then he has the Olympics. You know that like that asshole is going to like crash the podium when some American wins a gold medal and just like stand up there and like take it from them and assume that he actually won the 100 meter or whatever, like Maria Machado them.
He'll be in a war, like a Twitter war with the men's basketball team the entire time or something.
Yeah. We'll bomb Canada halfway through it. Yeah. That's an uplifting close. Well, look, I love the Olympics. Very fun talking with you from all the way over here. I will not be on the show next week because I don't even remember why. I think the logistics, we're flying back that day or something. Mm-hmm. But Ben's got a great guest host lined up for you. Do you want to announce it now or are you guys holding that?
Yeah, we're going to miss you, Tommy, but we've got a great guest host, Ayman Mojaldeen, who you know, Ayman. Just
great.
Unbelievably smart about the world, about the Middle East in particular. I'm sure we're going to be able to cover a lot of that ground. So we'll miss you, but Ayman will be here. I'll be in Munich this week for the Munich Security Conference. So I will be bringing some Euro gossip back with me.
Yes.
To the Worldos. I think I'm going to like Substack through this Munich Security Conference too. Like impressions.
I love it. I was actually WhatsApping with a German lawmaker who is the one who is interviewing AOC. At the Munich Security Forum. So she's all pumped. And it'll be great. I'm glad you're doing that.
By the way,
great choice for
AOC some props. I don't know if you saw her. She's been throwing haymakers. So she stood up for the Cuban people. I don't know if you saw her like pointing out.
No.
She basically pointed out the unbelievable humanitarian crisis that we are creating. Yeah. You know, whatever you think of the Cuban government, why is it normal that we're just like starving people to death, collectively punishing these people as part of this kind of regime change strategy. She took a massive whack at APAC after that New Jersey race. So I like this AOC moving into our space. She's usually been domestic. I like Worldo AOC.
She's great. She's really smart. She's one of the best speakers we got in the party. All right. Well, that's it for the news portion of the show. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you for enduring this time change. But stick around after the break. You're going to hear Ben's interview with Nila Tabrizi about getting laid off from The Washington Post, like what that experience was like, what we're all missing out on now that The Washington Post is, no foreign news coverage. So very important conversation. Don't miss it.
Pod Save the World is brought to you by 3 Day Blinds. If you're one of those people that needs to sleep in complete darkness, that is me, but your blinds always allow light in at the crack of dawn, you need 3 Day Blinds. They are the leading manufacturer of high-quality custom window treatments in the U.S., and right now, if you use my URL, 3dayblinds.com/world, they're running a buy one, get one 50% off deal. We can shop for almost anything at home. Why not shop for blinds at home too? 3 Day Blinds has local, professionally trained design consultants who have an average of 10 or more years of experience that provide expert guidance on the right blinds for you in the comfort of your home. Just set up an appointment and you'll get a free, no obligation quote on the same day. Not very handy? DIY projects can be fun, but measuring and installing blinds can be a big challenge. The expert team at 3 Day Blinds handles all the heavy lifting. They design, measure, and install so you can sit back, relax, and leave it to the pros. I can't even imagine trying to install blinds myself. 3 Day Blinds is great. We have it here at the office in all of our rooms. They work perfectly. We've had them for years. Nothing's broken, not even been updated. They work well, and I don't know, highly recommend it. 3 Day Blinds has been in business for 45 years, and they have helped over 2 million people get the window treatments of their dreams, so they're a brand you can trust. Right now, get quality window treatments that fit your budget with 3 Day Blinds. Head to 3dayblinds.com/world for their buy one, get one 50% off deal on custom blinds, shades, shutters, and drapery for a free, no charge, no obligation consultation. Just head to 3dayblinds.com/world. One last time, that's buy one, get one 50% off when you head to the number 3dayblinds.com/world.
Okay, I'm very pleased to welcome back to Pod Save the World, investigative reporter and author Nilu Tabrizi. She's also co-author of the book For the Sun After Long Nights, the story of Iran's women-led uprising, which we've recommended before, but truly, especially given what's going on in Iran, everybody should pick it up. But Nilu, so good to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, great to see you.
Okay, so let's just start with the big event in your life, which is you were part of the massive layoffs at the Washington Post. We're sorry for you for that, and we're sorry for the world for not getting the reporting of you and your colleagues. I just begin. I guess there was some sense something was coming. Were you still shocked by that this happened to you at the scale of this? Kind of describe the lead into that event.
Yes. So while I was reporting on a story about a massacre in Rosh in Iran, that's when I started hearing about these big layoffs that were coming. This was, you know, 2.5 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. We heard they were coming. We started to hear rumors. And we had heard at first that, management went to the head of the international desk and let them know that they were shutting down, you know, the Middle East team. Nearly all of the foreign bureaus would be shut down. And we had heard that Peter Finn, who's the head of international, who's been a mentor to so many at the Post, that he said, I'd rather be laid off than be a part of this plan. And so that started to trickle down. And so we started to put the pieces together just with people talking in the newsroom. And we learned, you know, that sports likely was going to get cut, international was going to get cut. But everything that happened was so much more severe than any of us prepared for. I mean, I was on the investigations desk. This was not a desk that was supposed to be cut or any of the rumors that we were hearing. And we lost a good number of people on my desk as well.
So how does this happen? I mean, so there's just practically speaking, you're all called onto some Zoom and they announce these layoffs and then you're packing up your desk. I mean, was it just a sense of the rug being pulled out from under you? And how did the person who did this explain why they were doing this?
Yes. So the run-up to the lead-off was really shocking. So I had my last story published in the newspaper on a Tuesday. It was about the buildup of vessels and aircraft in the Persian Gulf. So we're in a really precarious time. We get an email that evening that everyone has to be on a Zoom at 8:30 in the morning, Wednesday morning, and we are told not to come into the building and that there's going to be a significant restructuring and refocusing. And so all of these set off alarm bells, early Zoom, not being told to come into the building. And the way it was presented to us, it was a 30-minute Zoom call where Matt Murray, our executive editor, said that there had to be a significant reshuffling of the Post. Still unclear. Even when I think about that call, I don't really understand the vision or what they're trying to do. And then our HR rep came and we were told after this meeting, you're going to get an email from us that will let you know if your position is eliminated or retained. And I was one of the more than 300 people that got an eliminated email. And this is, you know, layoffs, unfortunately, are part of our business, right? This has happened. I was laid off from Vice 10 years ago. And it really pains me to say the way I was laid off from Vice was so much more humane than what I experienced at the Post. Because at Vice, we were called in. It was also a mass layoff. Our entire team was laid off. But I had the opportunity to, you know, look at who was laying me off and actually be able to speak and have a conversation. But we got these cold emails. And there was people that have been there for 27 plus years of service that were also laid off in this subject line email. So it was really... It has felt completely destabilizing and has been very ungrounding. And I'm lucky, you know, I'm a U.S.-based employee. I'm a member of the Post Guild. So, you know, I have some type of protections and things like that. And I have the safety of the guild. But I'm really concerned for people who don't, people who are international staff that are not U.S.-based employees, contractors, translators, drivers, all of this different local staff that supports our reporting. I mean, this is something that's being felt for so many people. And also, it's a horrible look in the industry. You know, other companies can look at this and decide that they may want to follow suit.
Well, give us a sense of the scale of what was lost in terms of foreign coverage. That's obviously what people come to this podcast for. What is being lost with those bureaus, both in terms of the reporting and the ability to get stories and communicate what's actually happening in places around the world. And also, like you said, I imagine the ripple effects are beyond the people laid off. It's the local fixers and it's the local stringers that maybe not show up on the balance sheet. But if the foreign desk is gone, that's probably, you know, hundreds of other people that are gone too, right?
Yes, we're still trying to understand that exactly how many people are affected. But this is a huge loss for our industry, for people who read our paper. I mean, so many important policymakers read the Washington Post. And so I think the ripple effects will be felt all over. So they cut the entire Middle East team. They cut... they cut the Ukraine team. So we had we had reporters that were there. We had Francesca Bell that was based in Russia. She was our Russia correspondent. She was also cut. I names that for me were the byline definers of the Washington Post are no longer there. Like, I had come to the Washington Post from the New York Times because I loved the coverage of the Post. And I loved, you know, Louisa Lovelock, Loveday Morris, Karim Fahim. Like, I could go on, people that have really inspired me. And we are all, you know, worse off not being able to read this reporting. And even right now, I mean, the area that I specialize in covering Iran, it's a really confusing moment, right? This is a story that is really important. It's in flux. You know, even the last story that I did about Iran was our extremely high traffic driver to our paper. It was a really high read, well-circulated story. And we're still in the middle of what's going on there. And so for me, there's people that took the risk to speak with me for work that I have to hit pause on right now. And that's something really difficult to tend with.
Yeah, actually, I want to ask you about that because, you know, yes, people might think this is terrible. There's already been a consolidation of a lot of farm bureaus, right? Like the LA Times used to have them, you know, the Baltimore Sun used to have them, right? Now it's basically the New York Times has them and the Wall Street Journal. But to your point, I read the Washington Post when I was in the White House. You know, it was like I read an intelligence report. You know, like it taught me something that was going on. Or your book, which, you know, kind of grew out of, I'm sure, reporting you're doing at the paper. One of the reasons people should read it, what's so extraordinary about it is, like, you see these protests in Iran, but you don't really know what's going on there. Or even people, you know, Iranian Americans, and maybe they can talk to their family, but you found literal journalists who would collaborate with you, take risks on the ground to get this story. And I read this, your reporting and your book, and I'm like, well, I understand this movement, the Women, Life, Freedom movement, you know, much, much better with much greater nuance and understanding and motivation than I would just kind of formulating an opinion based on what people have in X, you know, like, and so what do you think the texture is of our ability at a time when things are so complicated around the world? How much are we losing with these kinds of layoffs?
I mean, I don't even think we'll be able to grasp that until some real consequences come out from the fallout of this really, you know, short-sighted and horrific decision. I mean, for example, if we just look at Iran reporting, right, that's mostly what I was doing at Visual Forensics. My colleague Yegane was the Iran bureau, our Iran correspondent based in Turkey. She too was laid off. So both of us were laid off during this incredibly pivotal moment of reporting, right? I mean, over 6,000, close to 7,000 confirmed deaths of protesters in Iran that were killed in this latest uprising. This number will continue to climb. We're still trying to understand more about people who were killed, what the future of the Islamic Republic looks like. This is a really tenuous moment for Iran. And we don't have anyone there, right? We haven't had anyone based in the country since my colleague Jason Rezaian was unjustly imprisoned. And it was his 10-year anniversary of being released from Evin prison. And so we've had to figure out creative ways to do journalism from afar and do important accountability-based reporting. So what that's looked like for me in the context of reporting on Iran over the past month has been verifying extremely grim visuals and being able to take in all of these videos we're seeing from eyewitnesses and actually put together a story or a piece of analysis or an investigation from that. And I'm really crushed that our audience is going to miss out on that. And as well, policymakers who are reading our paper and trying to understand more about what's going on, they don't have access to that anymore. And there's just fewer and fewer places that do this really important work and foreign work on Iran and other countries. Like, the pool is shrinking. And healthy competition is really great for reporters. There's a camaraderie among reporters, and there's also I wish I could have gotten this story. And there's like a really important dynamic that is there. And once you cut that all off and it's just one or two news organizations that robustly cover an area, I mean, everyone loses in that. And that's really, really disappointing.
Yeah, I always felt like when I was in the White House, the Times, Post, Journal competition was very useful because they kind of push each other. Well, look, I mean, the elephant in the room here is Jeff Bezos, and we don't know what's in Jeff Bezos' head. What we do know that it's undeniable is that whether, you know, some years the Post was turning a revenue, some years it was losing money, but, you know, couch cushion money for Jeff Bezos. So, what is that? I mean, it's one thing, you would almost understand it more if it was like some family-run newspaper that, you know, survived on the revenue, and you could then tell yourself, well, these people like literally can't afford it. Jeff Bezos literally could afford to lose, you know, $1 billion a year running a newspaper. What is that like to know that there's someone who could have kept these positions and chose not to? And does anybody have any indication as to why that might be? We clearly changed the opinion section to suit Trump, but I don't know why you have to eliminate foreign coverage unless maybe he doesn't want people to know what's going on in places like Iran. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had an answer. I mean, I think that's why really important media reporting is crucial in this moment. I've been waiting to see. We have fantastic media reporters at the Washington Post, and I'm having to read about what happened in my own newsroom from competitors. And so that's also something that's really alarming. But I mean, yeah, you're right. It's poor leadership. It is really hard to know. It's just really hard to contend with the fact that someone who does own our paper could fund it, right? I mean, that's been brought up several times, but also the leadership that has been in place has just not been sufficient. You know, Will Lewis, who was our publisher, those recently left. I mean, he came to the newsroom once in his tenure. He made one speech to the newsroom, and generally, many of us didn't feel that he was very engaged beyond that.
Not exactly Marty Baron, you know, who, yeah.
No, I mean, and that's, you know, the culture of the Post, it's a really, really special place. Like it's the newsroom that everyone collaborates with each other. And even like there really isn't desk on desk trying to outscoop each other. Everyone's working with each other. And that's a really defining feature of the Post. And I think that this has really been harmed by this action. And if I'm trying to, again, read the tea leaves as much as you are, even though I was employed there. I'm trying to understand the strategy. Part of the strategy I'm hearing is, oh, we want to focus on national security. Well, your national security desk is only as good as your foreign desk,
yes,
right? Because
yes,
it's collaborative, and our foreign reporters will report out storylines, collaborate with the national security desk and do incredible, robust reporting. So I just feel like this was, it's hard to make sense of this decision because it feels completely irrational.
Well, I want to ask you about this, and maybe this relates to what, I mean, I also want to ask you what you're, you know, maybe too early, but if you have thought about what you're going to do, but the point you're making is so important. I want to emphasize it. Sure, you keep the Washington reporters who are reporting on national security, i.e. they're calling people like me in my old job, or, you know, they're, you know, getting in the intelligence community. I'm not diminishing that. That's really important. But I used to sometimes, I could feel like, because I was there during a period of media consolidation, and I used to find it was interesting that I would have Washington-based reporters calling me to ask me what was going on in Egypt, you know? And I'd be like, why don't you call someone in Egypt? I mean, I can tell you what we think is going on, but that is such a wrong way of looking at the world, right? I mean, if you only look at Iran, the country you've focused on, from the perspective of Washington, it's about our interests. It's about our politics. It's about, you know, it's not about people in Iran or even the leadership of Iran, right? So the question I want to ask, because I'm sure you agree with the premise, is where is that kind of reporting going to go? Because increasingly there are these kind of independent journalists who are like doing pretty extraordinary stuff online by themselves, but they don't have the infrastructure of a newsroom. There's the smaller giant, or not smart, there's a smaller number of giant organizations like the Times or the BBC. There's TikTok, you know, and just, you know, someone in Iran uploading a video that, you know, we can watch. I mean, how do you think we're going to get that non-Washington story about the world?
I think there are fewer and fewer places that we're going to get that from, right? Like you said it yourself. I mean, the Times is reporting robustly in like looking at foreign stories, so is the BBC, but that's kind of it now. And doing this type of work is really like it is a team effort, right? Because, you know, I'm verifying a video, I'm interviewing eyewitnesses, I'm writing the story. Well, every story that I've worked on has been made better by the people a part of it and by the editors who are part of it. And many international editors who were also mentors were let go. And also, you know, you need safety and infrastructure to do this work responsibly, right? You don't want to just send people into the middle of conflict zones without any training or any type of safety. Yeah. I mean, that's really dangerous. So this, you know, unfortunately just limits our access to information and makes it really dangerous for people who want to pursue this, you know, individually.
And do you have any sense of what's next? Your next chapter is, or is still digesting this? I'm sure.
My Oprah's next chapter. Yeah. I still, you know, the one bright part of this is that people have been so incredibly kind. Like people that I admire, companies that I love, have reached out, and I've been having great conversations with people. I'm also conscious of the fact that I've been going really full speed for the past year. So I do want to continue my investigative work. I want to keep reporting on Iran. I still want to do open source work. There are fewer and fewer open source teams too, to do this type of work. I have some ideas, but nothing set yet.
And last thing, I mean, since I have you, what is your impression of what's happening in Iran? I mean, we know kind of the machinations here, but kind of building on our conversation, do you have any sense of the mood in Iran at this kind of tenuous point where the protests have kind of generally been quashed? They may be bombed. They may not be. What's your read on the mood there?
Yes, I mean, I can say confidently, you know, there's been a little bit more internet access the past few weeks, which is nice. So I've been able to communicate with sources more. I have never encountered people with such across the board, just deep trauma that people are living in.
Yeah.
I've interviewed people on their worst days, but this is just awful. Everyone that I speak with just says like they can't even form thoughts. You know, one of my sources who's incredibly chatty said, next time we talk, maybe I should come up with a list of things I need to talk with you about because my brain can't process or bring in information. Or another source of mine said it was the first snow in Tehran a few weeks ago and you could still see blood underneath the snow. Like people are now living in this completely unprocessed trauma of the massacres that they have witnessed and have happened to their friends and loved ones. Everyone that I know, every source that I know, knows at least one or two people who've been killed. And that's just it's extremely difficult to process that. So, and everyone that I've talked to has extreme anxiety. They say, you know, we're waiting to be bombed at this point. Do you think it's going to happen or do you think it's not? And the other thing that's really difficult is this protest moment sparked out of a currency devaluation, right? But the shutoff of the internet and everything that happened in the last month, I mean, the job situation is even worse. It's not like the currency has leveled out, it's continuing. So by the government just shutting off the internet, well, a lot of people rely on the internet for their job and their livelihood. And that door has been, you know, really shut to people. So it's grim. It's a population of people who are in deep trauma and grieving and feel increasingly stuck and are waiting to see whether or not they're going to be hit with airstrikes.
Well, those are the kind of stories we need to hear. Nilo, where can people follow you in the meantime? Or are you kind of going to be on a social media cleanse?
No, you can follow me on X at @ntabrizi.
Okay. Well, look, I'm so sorry about what happened to you and your colleagues on like a personal level, but also just kind of a reader level, you know, and my hope is that you will find a way to do the kind of reporting you're doing and the evolving iteration of a media that doesn't just become so inward-looking. But if people want more, I really encourage people to pick up For the Sun After Long Nights. You will meet extraordinary people. You will see a protest movement from the ground up. You will understand Iran better, much better, by reading that book. It's really kind of a classic, actually, of a different kind of reporting that I'd seen, which is you collaborating with people on the ground. So thanks for that, and thanks for joining us to talk about what I'm sure has been not so great a week for you.
Awesome. Well, yeah, it's great to chat with you anytime. Thank you so much.
Great, thanks.
Thanks again, Anila, for doing the show, and I guess I won't see you next week.
Safe travels,
Yeah, it's crazy, man.
I'm safe. I mean, you'll be safe in Australia and New Zealand. Fun travels.
We'll be safe.
Yeah, yeah.
Fun
travels. Yeah.
Brisbane, Melbourne, Sydney.
I had a great night out in Brisbane at the G20.
Nice.
Kind of one of these epic Cody Keenan nights.
Yeah. I know.
Saw the sunrise, my friend.
Yeah. Awesome. All right, guys. Talk soon.
See ya.
Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Alona Minkowski. Our producer is Michael Goldsmith. Our associate producer is Anisha Banerjee. We get production support from Saul Rubin. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, and Ben Rhodes. The show is engineered, mixed, and edited by Jordan Cantor. Audio support by Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Thank you to our digital team, Ben Hefcoat, Mia Kelman, William Jones, David Tolles, and Ryan Young. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Adrian Hill is our senior vice president of news and politics. If you want to listen to Pod Save the World ad-free and get access to exclusive podcasts, go to crooked.com/friends to subscribe on Supercast, Substack, YouTube, or Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter for more original content, host takeovers, and other community events. Please subscribe to Pod Save the World on YouTube for access to full episodes, bonus content, and much more. And if you're opinionated like us, leave a review. Our production staff is proudly unionized by the Writers Guild of America East.